In 1926, an author named A.A. Milne wrote a children's book entitled Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh and all the characters in Milne's book are based upon stuffed toy animals in the bedroom of the author's son, Christopher Robin. The book has been translated into many languages, even Latin. And Winnie the Pooh, the book, holds the distinction of being the only book in the Latin language that made it into the New York Times bestseller list, into the top 10. When I was a child, my parents played a 78 RPM vinyl record of Jimmy Stewart about the adventures of Winnie the Pooh. We didn't have television during my early years, but listening to the stories of Winnie the Pooh allowed us to imagine wonderful happenings. It took us into the world of thought. The cast of characters, these are imaginary characters, with human characteristics included Piglet, that lovable little pig, who walked around like a person on his hind legs. And then there was Tigger, a very bouncy, extroverted tiger, who bounced around on his tail. And there was Eeyore, the woeful, introverted donkey who ate thistles. And then there was the owl and very nervous rabbit. And of course, the central character was the ever-hungry Winnie the Pooh, a caricature of the boy Christopher Robin's favorite stuffed animal. You may note the necktie that I'm wearing today of Winnie the Pooh. The Winnie the Pooh, of course, was Christopher Robin's teddy bear. And these imaginary characters were always getting into one predicament or another. And I recall a particular poignant and a tender moment. And I'm not quite sure if it was in the book or if it was in a Disney movie about Winnie the Pooh. And it was a quiet time when Winnie the Pooh said to his best friend Piglet, "Piglet, are you there?" Piglet reached out and held Winnie the Pooh's hand and said, "Yes, why?" And Winnie the Pooh answered quietly, "I just wanted to be sure." Don't we all want that assurance? To reach out our hand, to be able to be close to someone, have the comfort of a friend, to be able to know that someone is there, or as in Winnie the Pooh's words, just to be sure. Well, I've entitled today's message, Winnie the Pooh and You. Winnie the Pooh and You. I first thought about this message over 3 decades ago, and I talked to people who were tired. They were just tired. Spiritually tired, they were physically tired. They didn't feel as though they had any particular talent to contribute to the local congregation or to the work of the church as a whole. They felt frustrated or somewhat isolated or alone. Right now, we're in the middle of summer, but in the winter, our days draw shorter, and the daylight hours become fewer and fewer. And in the winter, we will leave for work or school in the dark in the morning, and then we'll get home at dark in the evening. In the northern states, some 600 miles or more north of here, there's even less wintertime daylight than we have in Arkansas. The days are shorter, the nights are longer. Recently, I heard from a friend in Russia who said, the sun was setting somewhere around, 10:30, 11 p.m., and it was rising at 3 a.m. Well, the sunrise was early because it's much farther north. Hopefully, I won't be investigated for talking to somebody in Russia. But you never know nowadays. But when the days are long, or the days are dark in the winter, and people tend to get discouraged, there's a name for that discouragement, when the days become shorter, because now they're long, but they're going to become shorter, and they call it seasonal affective disorder, where people feel sad, SAD, seasonal affective disorder. One study says that sad occurs in 1.7% of the population in Florida. Not very often. Pretty sunny there. Reputation for that. 9.5% of the people in Maine and other northern states, about 1 out of 10 people, are suffering from that seasonal affective disorder. And people from other countries, such as Finland or anybody around the Arctic Circle. Many years ago, I lived in another state, and there was a lady that was so stricken by this syndrome, she couldn't bring herself to leave the house. About 6% on average of people in America are subject to the seasonal affective disorder. Another 14.3% are affected by a mild form of that, or about 1 in 5 people have some kind of the winter blues. Now, why would I speak about the winter blues here in the middle of summer? We'll get there. But in the winter months, people become uncertain about themselves and become uncertain about others. They want to reach out, like Winnie the Pooh, to his best friend Piglet and hold hands, knowing that his best friend is there, and just say, I wanted to be sure. So today I want to examine biblical references to other people who had thoughts they were unsure of themselves. And then we'll review 7 points as to what God expects of us to provide for our reassurance. In the spring, summer, and fall holy days that are biblically spelled out throughout the Bible, when people gather together for these special occasions, and then there's a 6-month period from the fall to the spring holy days, and then sometimes people get sad during that winter time in that 6-month period. They don't have the regular reassurance. We also need reassurance, not just in the winter, but when we're a small group. And we can't say that we're all just the wisest, best of the lot that we can. We can think that, I guess. Not bad. But in 1 Corinthians 1:26, we're reminded by Paul in his letter to the Corinthians, for you see your calling, brethren, 1 Corinthians 1:26, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised has God chosen, yes, and things which are not, to bring to nothing things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. So God has called us. And I don't see us rolling in the billionaires club. They aren't putting our faces on National Enquirer for the latest exciting activities that we've done. And I have a small flock of sheep, 6 ewes and a ram, and each year they have lambs. Sheep are a flock instinct animal. They have a sense of security when they're together. And when they're alone, they simply don't do well. They're very anxious. They're very nervous. They're drawn to each other by this flock instinct. Jesus Christ referred to his church as a little flock in Luke 12:32. When Christ said, fear not, little flock, for it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Well, the people that God called out at this time are not gathering by the millions, but they consist of small groups of people who around the globe collectively add up to thousands of believers. All of the small groups everywhere in the church need reassurance. The Bible records someone who God called, someone who was definitely in the minority in his time. To make matters even more difficult, this man and his wife had to leave their home, the people they knew, and move away. And they moved several times. It wasn't just a one-shot deal. Finally, they traveled many miles away from the land of their birth. I'm referring to the man in Genesis 11 and 12, referred to as called Abram, later called Abraham, and his wife Sarah. Abraham didn't have a big congregation around to encourage him. He had to rely upon God for his spiritual reassurance, as well as his sustenance and physical well-being. Ultimately, God blessed Abraham, called him faithful, and extended the blessings through Abraham even to us. We read that in Galatians 3, verses 6 and 7. Abraham knew what it was like to be alone, yet he listened to God's instructions for his life, and God made him spiritually and physically a wealthy man. Scripture also records the history of another man who came along with Abraham from the land of his birth, and that was Abraham's nephew, Lot. His brother had died, and he had the responsibility to care for his nephew. Lot, Abraham's nephew, was blessed by being close to Abraham. But eventually Lot chose to depart from Abraham so that he could live in the city where there were lots of people, lots of excitement, lots of goods and services. In fact, a lot of young people today, what do they want to do? Let's go for the lights and the excitement of the big city. Because that's just all. You go home? Well, that's boring. Well, you know, what's at home? And this is a common young person's approach. And Lot succumbed to that, but unfortunately, Lot chose the city of Sodom. In Genesis 13, verse 12, In Genesis 13:12, Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. This Sodom area was a rough crowd. Lot and his household were then kidnapped and taken away, and Abraham chased after them and rescued them. Abraham was there for his family. He was looking out for them and Lot's family. We read that story in Genesis 14 and 15. I'm not going to go through it today. That's not my focus. But when God decided that the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah was so great that the cities must be destroyed, Abraham bargained with God in Genesis 19. He said, let's save. You know, if there's 50 righteous, will you save it? And he bargained with God until he bargained it down and to 45, to 40, to 10. Just save them. God said he would. It's got to be a pretty sad situation, but God, there were not even 10 righteous people in the city of Sodom. Now imagine, if there were only 10 left, God would have saved the city. But there weren't 10. And an escaping Lot, who escaped the city before it was destroyed, had to have felt the heat or of the fiery destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I called my daughter, who was leaving the camp, Ironwood in Minnesota, driving to Chicago, and I said, there's a tornado warning. I just got it in on my phone. And she was heading east, and I'm heading slightly west and south. And she says, I'm driving as fast as I can ahead of the storm. It's right behind me. I'm driving. The storm is moving 60 miles an hour. She's on a 70-mile-an-hour freeway. If she keeps up her speed, she can stay in front of the storm, which is fast-moving and vicious storm. So she says, I can't really talk. I gotta pay attention on the road. Well, imagine Lot. He's fleeing this circumstance, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, let's see. It'll be 2017. Let's see. It'll be 37 years ago. I was living in Eugene, Oregon, and about north of about 140 miles, there was a volcano that erupted on a Sunday morning on May 18th, 10:30 a.m. It was the top one-third of Mount St. Helens blew into the sky, and the blast was so strong that one-third of the mountain turned into volcanic ash. Enormous amount of energy that was released. The ash was a whitish-gray in color. The ash resembled powdered glass, and it was spread westward across the state of Washington, blowing as far away as Minnesota, over 1,700 miles away. A year later, it still looked like there were receding snowdrifts in the ditches, because you could see these drifts as I drove across that area in central and western Washington, even though it was hundreds of miles. People told their stories of the blast of Mount St. Helens. One church fellow was camping some miles away and told that in the middle of the day, the dust was so thick, he literally could not see the hand in front of his face in the middle, or at 10:30 in the morning after the mountain blew. He was on the opposite side of the blast from the mountain, but the dust was everywhere. Some people who lived there refused to relieve the trembling mountain before the volcano exploded, simply perished. A local T-shirt maker saw an opportunity to make a few bucks. And so what he did is he started making T-shirts that said across the front of it, I survived Mount St. Helens. The back of the T-shirt was tattered and full of burned holes, as though the wearer had run away from the volcanic eruption. The fire and brimstone as running away. And I'm thinking, there's Lot running away from Sodom and Gomorrah with a T-shirt saying, I survived Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, it was the same thought. But Lot left everything behind and escaped with his life. Abraham likely saw the glow in the distance from the destruction of Sodom, because when we look out upon the horizon, depending on where we're at with the hills and mountains and such, we can generally see up to 40 miles to the curvature of the earth before it prevents us from seeing farther. So we can see the glow of lights in the sky from farther away. As a boy growing up on the farm, we in Minnesota, we could look into the sky and we could see the glow of the cities that were around us. Maybe 10 miles in this direction, 20 miles in that direction, 15 or 20 miles, and you could look at the reflection in the sky, and you could see the clouds lit up from the lights of the cities down below. You could even pick out cities that were 60 miles away, like Minneapolis, St. Paul, this canopy or this big glow where the city is glowing all the time. So it was with Abraham. It's reasonable to assume that because the city went, that there weren't 10 righteous people. And it must have given Abraham a heavy heart to think that even his own nephew Lot perished in the destruction. He would have no way really to know otherwise. And then what do you think about Lot? How did Lot feel? How did Lot feel to be spared? He was saved alive when all of his neighbors perished in the destruction of Sodom. Presumably the fire and brimstone were all around him. Now he might have thought he was all alone, but everyone in the region was destroyed. His daughters thought that there was no one else on earth left alive. In Genesis 19:31, they simply said, "There's no one else left. This is it in the whole world." Many years later, generations later, there was a shepherd boy and a future king. His name was David. He was on the run to keep King Saul from killing him. David was an outcast living on the edge of society. And David had the power of the state chasing him, the power of the government. So he on a moment's notice, he could be in big trouble. It was over 15 years ago. There was a movie called The Enemy of the State. And it showed a fellow who was trying to escape the destruction of some government agency who was out there, and they had helicopters and airplanes and satellites and everything else that was trying. And he didn't know why they were chasing him. And he had tracking devices on his body and didn't know it. And he was scared. He couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything. And David was like that. He didn't know where to turn next, who could be his friend, who would be his enemy. In Psalm 22, verses 1 through 21, I'm not going to read it all. I'll just quote part of verse 12. But in Psalm 22, David was very, very worried that everything was collapsing around him. And there's a grassy area across the Jordan River, and it's a grassy area called Bashan. And they raised a lot of cattle there. And in Psalm 22, in verse 12, he says, "The bulls of Bashan surround me." I don't know how many of you have been to an auction barn, and you've seen what happened when they run cattle that have been raised out in the wild, and they run them in the auction ring. And there's a guy that's calling for bids, and he's in the ring. He has to hide behind the metal posts in order to be safe from these wild animals. They'll just take him out if they could. David felt like that, like the bulls with their horns could take him out. And yet he felt very, very much alone at that time. And he was relatively poor. He was on the run, and the government was trying to kill him. Many, many years later, his son, King Solomon, quite the opposite, had the power of the world. He had the riches and the pleasures that the world had to offer. And yet at the end of his life, in Ecclesiastes 1, if we can read about what he thought then at the end of his life in Ecclesiastes 1 and verses 1 through 14, and I'm not going to go through and read it all, but he said he felt empty. He said, "What's the use?" And here's quite the opposite, where he was the government, and he had it all, and yet he felt empty. He felt very much alone in that sense. But they weren't the only ones. There was the prophet Elijah. He thought he was the only one left, that no one was still worshiping gods. In 1 Kings 18, we can read the story, and I'll include it by reference here, that because hundreds of priests had been killed by Jezebel, the queen, Ahab and Jezebel, and Elijah was hiding to save his life. And so we read the story in 1 Kings 18, but unbeknownst to Elijah, there were 7,000 people that continued to be faithful to God, including, interestingly enough, the governor of King Ahab's household, Obadiah. And this one we can read in 1 Kings 18, 5 through 16, and 1 Kings 19, 1 through 10. How do you think Obadiah felt? Where his king and queen were very, very wicked, and he was in charge of their household. And yet, if he slipped up, that would be a problem. In fact, Obadiah secretly kept many priests who were faithful alive in a time of drought and gave them water and bread when it was scarce. Yet he had access to the king's resources and kept a number of God's people alive. And there are other examples throughout the Bible that people who felt they were alone at times. And the Bible is full of those stories. Jacob was on the run. Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, he was on the run, first from his brother Esau. And then years later, he escaped from the grasp of his father-in-law Laban. And that we read in Genesis 25 through Genesis 31. Jacob's son, and you had to be, when you're on the run, you got to be feeling alone. And we have the story there about he had to escape in each case. One of his youngest sons, Joseph, was cast into a pit, sold into slavery, falsely accused, and thrown into prison. We read it in Genesis 37. You have to feel pretty alone when you're in a pit. You got to feel pretty alone when you're thrown into prison. Unfortunate, uncomfortable circumstances that God chose to use for the good later. But many years later, over 400 years later, we have Moses, who fled Egypt to save his own life, and he spent 40 years in the wilderness before going back to Egypt to lead the Israelites to the Promised Land. How do you suppose Moses felt when he was beaten feet to get out of Egypt? The government was after him to do him in because the deed he was known. And yet, and then there was a captive prince of Israel called Daniel. He was hauled away to a strange land. Now, if we were taken captive, hauled away to a strange land, and yet even though he was a captive in a strange country, he chose to worship God despite the law that forbid him from worshiping the one true God. How alone do you suppose Daniel felt? And yet we're told he did pray three times every day, as was his habit. And then we fast forward to Mark 1, verse 16. And we look at the occupation of a number of the disciples of Christ, and they were called as fishermen. They went out in their boats, they fished and brought them in. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been to fish markets. The fishermen bring in their fish and they sell it when they bring it. They're out early at before daybreak in the morning, and they bring in the fish and sell it. It's hard work. But they were fishermen. What did they do after the crucifixion of Christ? They felt pretty much alone. And in John 21, verses 1 through 3, what did these fishermen do? They went back to fishing. They all felt the sting of discouragement. They needed reassurance, all of these. When I was a young man in the church, there was a fellow who was about 10 or 12 years older than me. And when he had come into the church, because he chose to keep the Sabbath day and to honor God's holy days, his wife left him, took his daughters, and moved away. To several states away. He knew the utter agony of separation, the pain of coping with a more than difficult situation. It was over 20 years later, I remember when I was going through a very heavy trial in life, and the agony of that trial seemed greater than I could bear. But I dragged myself to church every week, and I started to feel a connection with Job. You know, the guy that had lost everything, only except that I thought Job had it easy, except that I didn't have the boils. I was really grateful for not having the boils. And I came to church, just dragged myself there, and who would come and just stand beside me was that friend from over 20 years before, who I didn't understand what he was going through, and yet he just came and stood next to me. He didn't say anything. He just didn't say anything. He just stood there. He was there. He didn't wave a wand, sprinkle me with pixie dust. He didn't try to load me up with advice. He was just like the friendship of Winnie the Pooh and Piglet. My friend was just simply being there for me. And I look at these two times in life. First, when my friend was going through difficult times, and I was a young man, new in the church, and I really didn't know how to help him. I didn't understand the value of just being there. I didn't feel his pain. It was hard for me to understand that at that time. Well, it was over 20 years later, I was dealing with great grief, and my older experienced friend was a quiet and great comfort. And many years have passed since then, and we still keep in touch from time to time. Well, not for the last 2 weeks. And I'm pleased to call him my friend. And through his example, he taught me the value of just being there. So I want to go over 7 points on the value of being there. What is the expectation that Winnie the Pooh and Piglet had of each other, just to be sure? Well, the value of being there for someone and with someone, is, number one, we're fulfilling an expectation of God. God says, I won't leave you nor forsake you, in Hebrews 13, verse 5. In Hebrews 13, 5, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. When Moses was 120 years old and saw the promised land afar off, he was up on a mountain. God assured Moses that the children of Israel would be able to enter the promised land. In Deuteronomy 31:6, God told Moses, be strong, be of good courage. Do not fear or be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. We can rely on God. His laws are for our benefit. God hasn't abandoned the laws of gravity or inertia, or the other laws of physics, such as the tetrahedral bond of the carbon atoms into molecules, without which life as we know it simply could not exist. Nor has God abandoned his spiritual laws. Here's what God expects from us, and he puts it in writing. In Exodus 20 or Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 16, he tells us, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy or special. When Jesus Christ expounded on the law of God, he first mentioned that we're to love God with all of our hearts, in Luke 10:27. Christ answered and said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Of course, to show that we love God, then we keep his commandments. In 1 John 5:3, to demonstrate the love of God, it's spelled out, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. In fact, read the whole book of 1 John. It's short. But that's how we show our love, is by following what God says. And the Sabbath is an opportunity to show our love for God. Matthew 22, verse 37, it tells us that that's how we show our love and devotion to God. And then there are side benefits, other benefits, but just not showing our love to God, which brings us to the next point. Which is point two, by showing up at church each week, we have the opportunity to provoke each other to good works. Provoke, making things happen, good things happen. In Hebrews 10, verse 24 and 25, let's consider one another to provoke unto love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. This verse says we should provoke each other to good works. Now, not everyone likes the word provoke. I remember my parents would say, don't provoke your brother. Of course, they told my brothers that. I'm sure I never provoked them. Well, maybe a time or two. And I like the way the New King James Version puts the verse in Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 25. I think it more accurately conveys the instruction as compared to the King James. Verse 24, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as a manner of some, but exhorting one another so much more as you see the day approaching. So the King James says provoke, the New King James says stir up. And you know how it is, if you've got something that's settled to the bottom of the pot and you stir it up, it's more evenly distributed. Well, these things, two things are tied together. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, and then the stirring up to good works. You can't stir the pot if you don't put a spoon in there and actually use it. And sometimes we all need the poke, the little extra something that we get from keeping the Sabbath that God has reserved for our benefit. It's sort of like a use it or lose it. We have physical muscles as well as spiritual muscles. The implication here in Hebrews 10, 24 and 5 is if we don't assemble together, then we're not in a position to stir up each other to good works. And then point three, by showing up each week, we are in a position to help others. In Matthew 18, verse 20, by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. For in Matthew 18:20, for where two or three are gathered together in my name, I'm there in the midst of them. It's sort of like a synergy that develops that God respects, so that you have several together, that God will respect that congregation. We recall that Obadiah, the governor of King Ahab and Jezebel's household, was faithful to God, and he saved 100 priests in caves and fed them for 3.5 years. He was in a position to help others. There was someone else who was in a position to help others, and that was a girl named Hadassah, also called Esther, a Jewish gal. She was faithful to God when she became the queen of a foreign kingdom, the queen of Ahasuerus, the leader of the Medes and the Persians. She was selected. And Ahasuerus was the emperor of a land, and the land of his empire stretched from India to Ethiopia. Take a look on the globe. That's a huge area. And they didn't have planes, trains, and automobiles at that time, nor Roman roads. So they had to get there by horseback or camel or on foot. But they did have messenger systems. And this Jewish girl, Esther, had a cousin or uncle named Mordecai who told her that she was in a unique position to help others. In Esther 4, verse 14, when Mordecai told her, "Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" The words of Mordecai should ring in our ears. Perhaps each one of us is in a position to help someone else. But if we don't know the needs of others, how can we help them? Simply by being there, we can come to know our church family and how we can help others, and others know that and let others know that we would appreciate their help. I have a hard time letting other people help me because it was always, well, you know, being independent and stubborn and, you know, not acknowledging any weakness. So I didn't let on that I ever needed help. But by being close to each other, we can understand that when there's a possibility that we can step up to help someone else. Point four, by showing up each week, we raise our own level of expectations for ourselves. By showing up each week, we raise our own level of expectation for ourselves. In Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30, the parable of talents. And what did we go through? And Christ was explaining that those who were given a certain number, they were all given talents, and some multiplied those talents more. He expected everybody to do something with the talents that they had, even the person that was only handed one talent. And so that person wasn't expected to just sit on their hands. They were expected to use what was the gift that was given to them. We're reminded to be aware of our opportunities to serve God. Many other people came before we did into the truths of God, and they helped pave the way to provide for our spiritual growth. There's a letter sent out by the United Church of God president, Victor Kubik. I want to read little excerpts of it here because, and he writes in this week's letter, he wrote it on Thursday. He said, "When my wife Bev and I traveled to various church areas, people often asked, 'How can I do more in our congregation?' Often these are questions coming from young adults. They read of advancements in the work of the church and they want to be more engaged. There's a certain way that we can all be more engaged and useful to God and to our fellow church members. It's a very special way, but it requires focus and effort. And here it is. Give the gift that only you can give and give it regularly." What gift is that? And Mr. Kubik continues to write, "As a pastor who has the privilege of serving congregations of the Church of God for almost a half a century, I know that in each congregation there are people who stand out. They really make a difference. They're the ones who always seemed to have the needed words of encouragement, who knows what everybody's name and never seemed to criticize, who are happy to be at services. They spread joy and cheer. People are glad to see them and their fellow members. These people fulfill what Jesus commanded each of us, that you love one another as I have loved you, in John 13:34. That doesn't mean these people are perfect, but they're giving of themselves in a special way. Anybody can be like these people. Perhaps you already are one. As I know, the United Church of God is full of loving and caring people. But if you want to do better, if you want to give the gift that only you can give, the only thing stopping you is yourself. Here's what you need to do. To give the gift that only you can give requires one important thing. You have to be present. As we read in Hebrews 10:25, let us not neglect our meeting together, as some people do, but encourage one another, especially now that the day of his return is drawing near. Mr. Kubik continues, this cannot be done online. Attending services gives us the needed knowledge and inspiration, but is also a place where you give of yourself, as Paul admonished in what we just read from Hebrews. The book of Acts records in that very early days of the church that all believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship. That's Acts 2:42. The Greek word koinonia, translated fellowship, has deep meaning. It doesn't just mean simply to get together. It represents powerful dynamic of Christian living. The Greek word koinonia means to share, to give, to participate, to contribute, to have in common, to build a physical and spiritual community. Paul uses the word to describe a special gift from God, quote, the communion or fellowship of the Holy Spirit. And he uses that term in 2 Corinthians 13:14 and Philippians 2:1. So when we speak of our fellowship, which can be either a noun or a verb, Mr. Kubik notes, we speak of a very important spiritual state within the United Church of God. In the context of fellowship, Paul directs us to bear one another's burdens. During our lives, all of us will experience a time when we're in need. Sometimes we may just need someone to listen or simply be with us, particularly when we've suffered a major loss. Sometimes we need physical help. We can't do things for ourselves solely by ourselves. As a pastor, I've seen brethren time and time again selflessly give of themselves, often fulfilling a need even before someone can ask for it. It's inspiring. And the amazing thing is it often inspires others to follow the example. Here's something to consider as we continue to think about fellowship. Some of our younger people may not fully realize how important church services are to the older members of the congregation, especially those who are retired and may be living apart from their families. For these older members, attending services often represents the highlight of their week. It may be challenging and difficult for them to get out during the week, so they look forward to the time of fellowshipping with like-minded people on the Sabbath. These older members may be living in chronic pain. They may be a bit on the lonely side. They may be making a point to greet and talk and spend time with the older members may require focus and effort, but it represents a gift that only you can give. It's an important part of our opportunity to fellowship and give and share. The Apostle James tells us to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, which often requires some sacrifice on our part. There's a lot of single mothers and fathers who would greatly appreciate an invitation to dinner with their children, or a volunteer evening of babysitting so they could run errands or have some free time. When members drop by to visit or send a card of encouragement to those widows and elderly who can't get out on their own, that often represents a major gift. I've seen it and continue to see people in the church do exactly these things. Is there an opportunity for you? Great reward awaits you. Mr. Kubik continues, while there are many positive aspects of fellowship, there's a singular issue I'd like to mention. One thing that can quickly disrupt and tear a congregation apart is unwarranted criticism and gossip. It's an expression of human nature to talk behind people's backs, and it's hurtful even to the person doing the talking. Paul warns us all, if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. We can easily fall into the snare. So beware, if you have an issue with your brother, pray for courage and wisdom, and follow the biblical example by going to him in a humble manner. We each have a personal responsibility to promote peace. So this Sabbath, why not make a deliberate decision to show up and be a person of encouragement, cheerfully and gratefully seeking positive fellowship? Need some help? Be sure to pray that God himself would pour his love into your heart through the Holy Spirit. And that's writes Mr. Kubik in this week's letter. So by showing up, point four was each week we raise our level of expectations for ourselves. And this brings us to point five. By showing up each week, we provide strength to the spiritual mother, the church. By showing up each week, we provide strength to the spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. The church is referred to as in Scripture as a mother, 1 Thessalonians 2:7. As a members of the church, we're to provide for those who come to church for refuge. And in 1 Thessalonians 2:7, Paul writes, "But we were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children." As we know, a nursing mother has a special relationship with her child, a loving care, a bond. So too are we as church members to be caring for others. We also know that the church has needs and that by sharing burdens makes a lighter load for everyone. Not just a physical burden, but our emotional burdens as well. We can be there as a gentle nursing mother, comforting each other. Number six, we show up by showing up each week, we encourage others with our example. One way we do that is by worshiping God through music, which we do at the beginning, in the middle, and the end of every service. And the psalmist is full of instructions about singing to God or even making a joyful noise. In fact, seven times the term joyful noise appears because not all of us have the voices like most of you do. And so if we take a look, sing to the Eternal with a cheerful voice, our hymn number 58. That's really Psalm 100. Hymn 59, also Psalm 100, singing with a cheerful voice. Or hymn number 30 and Psalm 50. There are just many cases where we praise God and singing with a joyful noise. A cheerful voice and at least making a joyful noise. And it's hard to do if we're just one person singing a solo each week. But we do this together, and there's a blend of voices. And then point seven, by showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. There's an old saying that idle hands are the devil's workshop. The word idle, I looked up, appears 18 times in the New Testament. What would we do if we didn't focus on the weekly Sabbath? Would our activities take us away from learning more about God and his ways? Would we spend more time on the job? Maybe watch more television? Maybe do more of our school lessons, pursue sports activities? Maybe we're a participant or just an observer? Would we spend the Sabbath time focusing on our own pleasures that draw us away from God? We're told about King Solomon in 1 Kings 11:1 and 2. What happened with King Solomon? He loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, the women of Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. Verse 2, of the nations concerning of which the Lord said to the children of Israel, "You shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they'll turn away your heart after their gods." And Solomon clave to these in love. Solomon's heart was drawn away by strange women. This doesn't mean they were odd. You know, that they, you know, particularly odd acting or grew horns or anything, or that they had maybe blue skin, whatever. Strange is a term that's used in the Bible for those who were not followers of God. Notice in verse 2, the real problem is in 1 Kings 11:2, that the strange influences will turn people's heart away from God. Solomon's weakness, well, one of his weaknesses was women. This is recorded in the Bible so we can each examine ourselves and we ask, what's our weakness? His was plastered into the Bible to embarrass him for all time. Do we allow Satan then to feed our weaknesses? Well, just by being there for each other each week, we can reinforce each other and our belief in the true God, and we can be strengthened so that we're able to resist Satan's influence. The opportunities to depart from God are endless. In Job 1, verse 7, because Satan is constantly on the hunt for people. Job 1, verse 7, and the Lord said to Satan, "Where do you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it." Satan goes to and fro on the earth. He seeks to accuse us. We know he's the accuser in Revelation 12:10. "And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now has come the salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God, the power of his Christ, for the accuser of the brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night.'" And I might add, you know, we think of these as false accusations, but sometimes they're true accusations. How many of us want our sins posted on a billboard when we drive down the freeway? Satan can use the truth against us too, which is painfully awkward. So what's the solution? James 4, verse 7, "Submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." That's putting up your power shields. He can't get in space talk. But of course, being close to God means following God's instructions on a daily and weekly basis. And then surrounding yourself with like-minded believers. I recall a wise man's instructions one time. How to get air out of a glass was to put water into that glass. So we can resist the devil and his temptations, staying close to God, filling up our spiritual glass of water. And then when we're filled up with God's Spirit, we are able to resist Satan. Christ rebuked Satan. Luke 4:8, and Jesus Christ answered and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for it's written, 'You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.'" So Christ set that example. Just rebuke Satan when you sense that coming on. One of the ways we're able to refill our spiritual glasses each week is simply by being there. There's Winnie the Pooh and Piglet holding hands, just reassuring each other. But we should never underestimate the value of being there. So a summary on those 7 points. By showing up each week, we fulfill an expectation of God. Then meaning, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy or special. Number two, by showing up each week, we can provoke or stir up others' good works, others to good works. Stir up ourselves to good works too, for that matter. Number three, by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. Number four, by showing up each week, we're in a position... We raise the level of expectations for ourselves. Number five, by showing up each week, we are providing strength to the spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. Number six, by showing up each week, we encourage others with our example, whether in song or in service. Number seven, by showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. So just as Winnie the Pooh asked Piglet if he was there, and Piglet reached out his hand, and Winnie the Pooh expressed a deep need in all of us, and he said, "I just wanted to be sure." We can also be sure. We can be sure when we attend weekly church services. We can be sure when visiting those who are hospital patients or shut-ins. We can be sure by going to funerals or to comfort the grieving. We can be sure when we're serving at church functions, whether it's locally or at a holy day or at a summer camp. We can reach out our hands to others simply to be there for them, because we all want someone to be sure that someone is there for us.